WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gerald Ford has the distinction of being the only president who was never elected president or vice president. When Nixon resigned on August 9, 1974, Ford had to hold the government and the country together. The first month of Ford's presidency is the subject of the new book, 31 Days. The book also explores the early careers of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney when they were Cold War hardliners and worked in the Ford administration. My guest is the author of 31 Days, Barry Wirth. Remind us of the unique position that President Ford was in, having never been elected as vice president.
Gerald Ford became vice president in October of 1973 after Nixon's first vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned. He was facing a tax evasion charge. And there's so many things that make the Ford presidency unique, but one of them is that there were two-thirds Democratic majorities in Congress at that time, and Ford was not Nixon's first choice. In fact, he was probably his fourth or fifth choice, but the Democratic leadership in Congress made it very clear that only Gerry Ford would be acceptable. So Ford was chosen, and he had no aspiration to be president, so he was chosen more or less by mutual consensus between the White House and Congress, and he was chosen quite specifically because he didn't have any ambition to run for president himself. So when he came to office 10 months later, after Nixon's resignation, he was widely believed that he was not going to be running in 1976 in his own right, that he was going to be a caretaker. So here we have a man who was not elected to national office, had no aspiration to run for the presidency on his own, and had less than 48 hours to prepare for his presidency. Nixon, as we well remember, struggled to the bitter end to retain power and only left when confronted with certain impeachment in Congress. And when Ford was told that he would become president, he had 2 days to assemble a staff and to organize himself to become the world's most powerful political leader.
There was a transition team that was organized to help President Ford, and this transition team recommended that Ford not appoint a chief of staff at the outset, but that instead of a chief of staff, he should appoint someone who could rapidly and efficiently reorganize the staff, but who would not be perceived as chief of staff and would not be eager to become a chief of staff. And when Ford read this recommendation, he wrote in the margins, Rumsfeld. And that's the person who he chose. Why did he want Rumsfeld to be this transition manager?
Back in 1974, Rumsfeld was a former congressman from Illinois who had been instrumental in helping Ford rise through the congressional leadership. He was, fortunately for him, out of the White House during the most critical stages of Watergate. He was our NATO ambassador. But Ford knew that he needed to bring in somebody who would help him implement what he called a spokes-on-the-wheel organizational chart, as opposed to a top-down organizational chart, and who would not be afraid to move against the Nixon staff, somebody who was aggressive and unafraid to take on complicated problems, a maverick. He was comfortable with Rumsfeld from their service together in the House, and he thought that Rumsfeld was just the guy. But as you indicated in that that quote that you read, he wanted somebody to run the transition who did not want to be in that position and would not be perceived as wanting to be in that position. Ironically, just a couple of weeks after the pardon, Rumsfeld became Ford's so-called staff coordinator, but in fact he was chief of staff in the White House, and Dick Cheney was his deputy.
One of the big decisions Ford had to make was whether to keep Nixon's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. Why was that a controversial decision?
The Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy, which was generally known by the term détente, which meant a lessening of tensions, was very controversial within the Republican Party. There were a lot of hardliners and hawks who felt that Nixon had gone soft on communism and that Kissinger's realism in foreign affairs was making the United States, as they put it, provocatively weak. It was probably the first truly controversial decision that Ford made. At the time, as someone put it, Henry Kissinger was America's foreign policy. Nixon had been so discredited by Watergate that Kissinger was America's face to the world. He was enormously popular, and he was enormously effective during the previous year in negotiating settlements between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria in the wake of the 1973 October War. So Ford felt very strongly that he needed Kissinger, but he knew that he was going to be inviting attack from the Republican right and from the so-called neocons who were just then beginning to address foreign policy issues.
And where did Rumsfeld stand on this?
At the time, Rumsfeld's charge was to stay away from foreign policy entirely. That was Kissinger's alone to run. When Rumsfeld and Cheney came into the White House to work on the transition, Ford was very explicit. He said, look at the Office of Management and Budget, look at the relationship between the White House and the cabinet departments, but stay away from foreign policy, stay away from defense, stay away from state. Subsequently, Rumsfeld challenged Kissinger, but at the time, Rumsfeld's duties were generally regarded as having to do totally with domestic politics.
What do you feel like you could learn about Rumsfeld and his deputy, Dick Cheney, by looking at their performance in the Ford administration?
Well, let me put it this way. Ford started out feeling very strongly that after Watergate and Vietnam, what the country needed to do was to move to the center. He adopted what one of the Washington Post writers called the mantle of the presidential center. The country had been so divided, so torn, and all power was reeling, and Ford was determined to unify the country. So he made a number of what in retrospect looked like extraordinary decisions. The first trip that he took outside of Washington, he went to the VFW convention in Chicago, really the most difficult audience he could find, to suggest that Vietnam War resistors should be welcomed home. There should be some sort of limited amnesty. He met with the Congressional Black Caucus, which Nixon had not met with for 5.5 years, only once, in fact, did Nixon meet with that Congressional Caucus. He chose as his vice president Nelson Rockefeller, who was widely despised on the Republican right. And in fact, the choice of Rockefeller catalyzed right-wing opposition to Ford and galvanized support for Ronald Reagan, who challenged Ford in the 1976 primaries. So what you had was a president starting out trying to move to the middle, trying to work with the Democrats. And then with the pardon, his popularity plummeted, went from 70% to 48%, and never really recovered. At which point, Rumsfeld and Cheney came in and tried to direct the Ford presidency, which was increasingly faced with a challenge from the right. And they moved Ford as much as they could to face that challenge and to implement right-wing policies himself. So in the same sense that Rumsfeld and Cheney became the center of strategic power in the George W. Bush White House, they became the center of strategic power in the Ford White House, and they did then, in somewhat lesser form, what they have done subsequently, which is to make sure that they never get outflanked by the right.
One of the things that President Ford had to do early on was to choose a vice president. What does the Constitution say about the position that he was in and how to choose a vice president?
The Constitution didn't have a provision about this in well into this century. And in fact, after John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, there was no vice president at all until Lyndon Johnson was elected in his own right in 1964 and Hubert Humphrey came on. After that, Congress passed the 25th Amendment, which says that if there's an unoccupied vice president's seat, that the president shall choose someone who to be confirmed by Congress. So this was really the signal decision of Ford's first couple of weeks. He was having the opportunity to pick somebody who, as far as anyone knew, was most likely going to be the Republican candidate in 1976, since Ford himself had pledged not to run.
So how was Rockefeller finally chosen by Ford as vice president?
Well, it's Ford wanted somebody who had independent standing and stature. And Rockefeller was, in his own right, one of the world's most powerful people, coming from his family and also having been the nationally very popular former two-term governor from New York. And he also wanted somebody who would be a strong ticket mate in 1976. Rockefeller, it was believed, could help Ford win New York, probably California, maybe Florida. And he also was in agreement with the Nixon-Kissinger realpolitik in foreign affairs. So Rockefeller was really the strongest person that Ford could have selected.
You keep describing Ford as being someone who didn't plan on running for the presidency, and no one expected him to run for the presidency. His vice presidential appointee was considered to be the next presidential candidate, but that's not the way it worked out. Ford did run.
Yes, he did run, and in fact, he made the decision very early. Let me say first that Betty Ford had hated being in Washington and had, as we know, struggled with addictions and had had a very hard time as a political wife and really hoped that Ford would quit politics. In fact, Ford had planned after the 1972 election to leave Washington. His only real aspiration had been to be Speaker of the House, but he had not been able to win enough seats to make that happen. And so he first had to convince Betty that that he ought to run himself. But really what was more crucial, which was pointed out to him by Henry Kissinger on the second day of his presidency, was that if he was perceived as a caretaker, that would invite a succession fight within the party that would begin immediately, and that foreign powers would take him less seriously. He realized that in order to be perceived as a strong president, even during this interim period, he needed to run in 1976 and show that he intended to be president for longer than that.
My guest is Barry Wirth. His new book is called 31 Days. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barry Wirth. We're talking about his new book, 31 Days, which is about the first 31 days of the Ford presidency right after the resignation of President Nixon. One of the most important decisions that President Ford was faced with early on was whether or not to pardon Nixon. Why was that a decision that was filled with landmines along the way?
That's a very apt description. This could not have been an easy or straightforward decision under any circumstances. It was probably made more difficult by the fact that Ford owed his presidency to Nixon. But let me try to go through some of them. There were the legal issues first. Nixon had been named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate cover-up. He was being investigated in connection with another dozen abuses of power, and the legal brief against him had grown enormous. And there was no question after the Watergate tapes came out that he was going to be indicted. The special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, did not want to indict him. He was looking for every opportunity to transfer the responsibility to somebody else. On top of all that, Nixon was quite ill. We'll never know exactly how ill, but he had suffered from phlebitis, which had caused him great pain, and it caused enormous swelling in his leg and had threatened to cause a stroke or a heart attack if he had a clot that got loose and into his bloodstream. Besides all that, he was obviously depressed. There were reports that he was drinking and suicidal. So Ford felt really enormous pressure right from the get-go from all sides to pardon Nixon, simply to put the Watergate morass behind the country in a way that only he could, by one swift and decisive act of presidential compassion and leniency.
Now, you think that there were personal issues in Ford's life that also led to him pardoning Nixon. What was the personal issue?
We tend to forget this now, but Gerald Ford was not born Gerald Ford. He was born Leslie King Jr. His father and mother divorced shortly after he was born. In fact, his father had started physically abusing his mother on their honeymoon. He was an alcoholic. In their divorce agreement, he was obligated to pay child support for Ford during his growing up in Michigan, and he was a deadbeat. He never paid any of it to the point where when Ford was 25 years old and a law student at Yale, Gerald Ford's father, Leslie King, was put in jail briefly. Ford, in that, finally took the situation and became a broker between his parents. He brokered an agreement that his father would pay his mother a lump sum and the legal proceedings would go away. And this was a way of him closing out a chapter of real strain and difficulty that had dogged him throughout his life. And I believe Ford, on top of all these other pressures that he was feeling, had a kind of inner urgency to just resolve this as only he could by splitting the difference between the parties and sealing the record and getting Watergate behind the country and behind the White House so that he could go ahead and do what he needed to do, which is to lead the country out of Watergate and Vietnam.
So what was the reaction to Ford's pardoning of Nixon?
It was overwhelmingly negative. As I said earlier, Ford's popularity went from 70% to 48% and never really recovered. And it aborted what he was trying to do. After that, he was distrusted. The pardon ended up looking like the last cynical act of the Watergate cover-up. Here was President Nixon's handpicked successor telling the country that Nixon would not have to go to jail or even face trial, while 40 of his subordinates had faced legal proceedings.
Three of the people who were in the Ford administration, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz, eventually became to be considered hardliners. Were they considered hardliners in the Ford days?
Rumsfeld, was the least ideological of the three of them. But yes, I think they definitely were considered hardliners. There were many people in the military and on the right who felt that that Nixon and Kissinger had compromised America's strength, and that America needed to be strong and to be able to assert its strength around the world. And I think that was the definition of hardliner. Certainly Cheney and Wolfowitz were among that group.
What was Wolfowitz's position in the Ford administration? He went on to become a Deputy Secretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration and was considered to be one of the architects of the Iraq War.
Wolfowitz was nowhere to be found in the first 31 days. He showed up in the Ford administration as one of the key members of what was referred to as Team B. One of the things that Rumsfeld did the first time that he was at the Defense Department was he convinced Ford to set up a group that would independently review all of the intelligence that was coming into the CIA regarding the Soviet Union and its nuclear programs. They felt that the CIA was underestimating the Soviet threat. So Rumsfeld established this Team B. Wolfowitz was a key figure in that. This must have been 1974, 1975. And Team B issued a report which said that the Soviets were bent on world domination, that they were building space-based weapons to destroy us. Practically everything in that report turned out not to be true. But the Team B report became a rallying cry for hardliners who felt that that the United States had become weak and needed to become mightier and assert that might around the world. So this was really, in a way, a kind of a bookend to the so-called independence intelligence gathering that was done in the Defense Department in the run-up to the Iraq War, in which Wolfowitz was involved.
And did Cheney and Rumsfeld support Team B in their conclusions that later?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think this, by the end, Nixon had negotiated the first strategic arms reductions and was in the process of negotiating what was called SALT II, which was the second stage of that. By the end of the Ford presidency, Rumsfeld and Cheney had pretty much run SALT II into the ground. The word détente was no longer used in any of Ford's speeches, and the United States was starting to assert a more militant posture towards the world. This was part of their answer to Vietnam, which is, we didn't lose Vietnam, we're stronger than ever.
Do you feel like you understand Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz any better from having studied their role in the Ford administration?
The Ford administration was truly the formative experience for them. I think they developed their their attitudes towards the world and their position on America's role in the world as the sole superpower during that period. Of course, then we were still engaged in the Cold War with the Soviets, but this is where they prepared and trained for the power that they have had in the Bush administration. So in that sense, it's like going back to somebody's childhood to sort of figure out why they became the way that they did. I think we can understand a lot about Rumsfeld and Cheney by looking at how they became powerful the first time. And it should be remembered that at the time, Rumsfeld was 44 and Cheney was 33. When he became White House Chief of Staff, he was 35, the youngest Chief of Staff in history. So this was really his training.
Barry Wirth, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Barry Wirth is the author of the new book, 31 Days. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.